Welcome everybody to Take a Hike Diabetes. Tonight we are having a community call with Marionette Audifrin. She is one of my favorite humans on this planet. I had her on the virtual campfire earlier this year to talk a little bit about her adventures in the outdoors and her work with Girl Trek, which is an amazing organization that's working to get Black women outdoors and practicing radical self-care through the simple act of walking, which is a really interesting tie-in with the diabetes thing, because when you look at the prevalence of diabetes among racial groups, Indigenous folks have the highest prevalence, and then Hispanic folks, and then the Black community, and then Asians and others, and then non-Hispanic white folks. So what Girl Trek is doing is paramount for diabetes prevention, diabetes management, especially given how prevalent it is in the Black community. And Marionette's son has diabetes as well. So tonight we're going to be talking about how to care for folks with diabetes, things you can do in your community to not make to make sure nobody gets left behind, and how to just make sure everybody feels good and is taken care of. So Marionette, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Yes,
a different kind of topic. Different kind of topic. But yeah, one that I am well acquainted with.
Yeah, so I think let's jump straight into it. I know your son lives with diabetes. You want to talk a little bit about his diagnosis, what his experience has been like, and what it's been like to parent somebody with diabetes?
Yes. So my son will be 19 this month. He's had diabetes for 18 years. He was diagnosed
at
a year old, 13 months. And it came as a complete shock. His symptoms were, now that I look back on it, the classic symptoms. He was still in a crib, for goodness sakes. And I can remember one night, talking to someone on the phone and having the baby monitor there and hearing him throw up. And so I put the phone down, ran to him. And not only had he thrown up, he was wet from head to toe. I mean, like a bath wet with urine. And I was like, this is crazy. I mean, I gave you a bath. You went to bed dry. And so this literally went on for about a week and a half, almost 2 weeks of this wet, dry. And I'm WebMD, I don't even know if WebMD, I mean, it was out by that time, but I don't know how long WebMD, but he had had a number of like little infections. He had a urinary tract infections. He was dealing with ear infections. A lot of things were attacking his body previous to that. So I'm thinking, part of this is all tied in together. Diabetes never entered my mind. So I type in his symptoms into WebMD, and this is probably after a week of this going on. And it came up either diabetes or a urinary tract infection. And I'm thinking, surely this is not diabetes. This must be a urinary tract infection, which he had already had. So I'm thinking, I just need to make an appointment with the doctor. While I'm waiting for the appointment, the thirst thing hits. And this boy has finally started walking, and he's toddling over to the refrigerator, pulling on the refrigerator because he wants something to drink. And I'm letting him drink anything. If it's juice, I'm letting him drink it. If it's milk, I'm letting him drink it. If it's water, because I don't know what, you know, the signs are. Now, my mother had gestational diabetes, but I don't think that I really knew that she was still struggling with that because she hid it from us. Had I kind of known that, I might have put two and two together. But even when we finally got the doctor's appointment, which was 2 days before Christmas, I didn't tell the doctor that I suspected diabetes. I just went in and I said, you know, he's having problems. You know, it might be he's not dealing with the antibiotics that he had before, you know, just made up stuff really. And they said, okay, we'll try him on, you know, for something else. He might have a urinary tract infection. At that time, you know, they're giving out antibiotics like it's willy-nilly. And I said, well, before we go, I said, by the way, this is some of the other stuff that's been happening that I've noticed. They took his diaper off. It was heavy. Okay. They took the diaper, I guess, went and did a test. The doctor came in. They said, do not pass go. Do not collect $200. Head straight to the hospital. It's Christmas. I'm expecting my parents to come in. And he more than likely has diabetes. They didn't even tell me what his reading was. I'm sure it was off the charts. And my husband says, no, don't go straight to the hospital. Bring my son, in true African fashion, bring my son home. Your parents are coming. I will take my son, ha, 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 Wakanda style, to... to the hospital. And that's how we did it. He wouldn't even allow me to spend the night with him in the hospital. He had to train me on an orange. My husband did on how to, you know, give him a shot. And that's where our life kind of began with diabetes, you know? So, wow. Yeah. Pretty scary stuff.
Wow. I mean, yeah. And so he has type one?
Type 1.
Yeah. So do you want to talk a little bit about the difference between type 1 and type 2? Because there are some serious differences. And I know that there's a lot of, one of the things that we're really passionate about at Hiking My Feelings and with this program is like uniting everybody with diabetes, because there's like, I think there's 1.5 million people with type 1 diabetes diagnosed in the U.S. And then like 34 million people with type 2, and then 80 something million with type 1 or pre-diabetes. So let's talk a little bit about the differences. And then I have some other questions about just like what it's like to go from like a baby up until 19 and going out in the world with diabetes. So type 1, what's the deal?
So type 1 essentially is your body is not... The quick version is your body is no longer producing insulin, which deals with how to break down the sugars so that your body can use it. It's been destroyed. There's nothing coming out of your pancreas. And that's basically what it is. There's no amount of exercise. There's no amount of diet that's going to change it. Some people go through a honeymoon stage where you still have, your body might be producing a little bit. And so, you know, you're kind of transitioning into full blown. That was not my son's experience. He went from straight from, you know, being able to tolerate, you know, foods to nothing. No honeymoon. Yeah. He had to go straight to full dosage of insulin, and trying to figure that out was a nightmare. Whereas with type 2, it's preventable. Let's just, you know, it's preventable. Let's be honest with ourselves. It's a lifestyle situation that can be, you know, better managed or even reversed with diet and exercise. But the more you ignore that, the worse it gets. And that's when you get into the amputations, and you start losing toes, and, you know, it causes heart problems. That's how Luther Vandross died. You know, a lot of people die from complications, blindness. You know, those are the complications of not managing type 2 diabetes. And then you have the pre-diabetes, which you may as well just, that's what they tell you initially. Oh, yeah. You've got pre-diabetes. Well, your A1C levels might be slightly elevated, and they're not quite at the range of, you know, your blood sugars are not quite 126, because they say if it's 126 and above, then, you know, that's the type 2, but you're elevated, you're above the 110, you're, you know, 115, when you should be down 99 or less, you're in that, you know, that area. So that's where the pre-diabetes, and that's your biggest opportunity to to make real change. That's where they have diagnosed me. You know, yeah. since I moved here, moved back to the States in 2013, you know, and I was living overseas and, you know, would only come back home once a year. And that's when I started finding a whole lot of stuff during my physicals, hypertension, the classic stuff that, yeah. you know, you find out as you're getting older, as you know, you're less active, as you're gaining weight in your mid 40s and your mid 50s, be careful, it's coming, baby. And, you know, menopause, which for me right. started at in my early 40s, you know, so by the time... What?
I'm not ready for that.
Man. I'm not complaining. I am not complaining at all. It's lovely. I'm not going to the store once a month, you know. So, you know, but that diagnosis for me, those two diagnoses came together for me, hypertension and the pre-diabetes, which really is a double whammy. It's a double whammy. And the doctor basically told me, if you do not take care of this lifestyle wise, then you're going to end up with complications down the road from one or the two of these things that are going to prematurely, he basically said, going to prematurely alter your life and maybe even kill you, you know?
Yeah.
So that's the long and short of it. Type 2 lifestyle can be managed with lifestyle changes. Diet changes, smoking, drinking, mm-hmm. alcohol, all of those things over a period of years add up, really add up.
Yeah. So. Yeah. And I think the thing that's interesting and isn't talked about enough with diabetes type 2, because like type 1, you're like, it's autoimmune. There's no fixing yeah. it. We're looking for a cure. Like there's no right. insulin production whatsoever. Type 2, there's a lot of shame and stigma around that diagnosis because it can be prevented and because of lifestyle changes. But one of the questions that I'm trying to answer through all of our work in this campaign, Take a Hike Diabetes, which is like this program is our kickoff to what we're doing next year, through our storytelling, through our exploration of just like talking with other folks, I'm curious because in my particular case, my diabetes was tied to trauma from a sexual assault I survived in college and never got help for. So that led to unhealthy coping mechanisms like eating and right. drinking my feelings. And then I discovered through hiking, like these are the dots that I'm connecting. Oh my God, I'm hiking my feelings instead of eating and drinking them. Thank you, diabetes. Because I couldn't do eating and drinking my feelings anymore if I wanted to be a good diabetes patient. So right. my question is trauma a root cause of diabetes? And if so, if we treat the trauma, can we treat diabetes differently, if not just eradicate it completely? Because trauma is a big factor in developing these kinds of unhealthy coping mechanisms that can lead to that kind of diagnosis. And if we look at it through the lens of prevalence by racial group, if you think about Indigenous, Hispanic, Black communities, Asian communities, and the trauma those communities have faced, especially in the United States, then you could say, like one could guess that, yeah, maybe right. trauma is a problem and a root cause of it. And I think one of the other things that's important to mention too about type 2 with regards to the shame and stigma is like, yes, ultimately at the end of the day, it is my choice what I put in my body. It is my choice how I move it. It is my choice how I manage my stress. But there are a lot of factors that are stacked against us too. Like right. if you live in a food desert, you're right. not eating fresh, healthy vegetables. You're probably right. having Pop-Tarts and sugar-loaded cereals for right. breakfast, right? Like,
right.
so there's right. that. There's the, if you're working two or three jobs because you're severely underpaid and you're just trying to keep food on the table, you might not have time to exercise. So it's like, it's not either or, it's yes. And like, yes, you can manage it with lifestyle choices. And also not all of us have the same foundation from which to make said choices or have access to the things that help us make healthy choices.
Right.
So it's such a tricky disease on both sides of the thing. And that's one of the things. So Saturday is World Diabetes Day. We're encouraging everybody to get out for a hike to celebrate and bring awareness and just get your body moving and like work to prevent it or, you know, manage your blood sugar levels if you're living with diabetes. But one of the things that I'm really passionate about is like uniting all people with diabetes, because if we're talking about like who has it worse, like type one, you're like, well, I can't do anything. I can't exercise it away. I can't eat better to make it go away. We're going to make a lot more impact as like 100+ million people with type one, type two, and pre-diabetes than we are like as individual segments of this disease group. So when it comes to like your son and his growth through this, like you talked about learning how to practice on an orange to like administer insulin. What other challenges have you faced as a parent going through this with your child?
I think because he grew up, he was diagnosed so early. And then like within a year after his diagnosis, we moved abroad to a country where you want to talk about stigma. You know, I can't even tell you the stigma of moving to an African country. And here is a young child who has to prick himself with a finger. He understands this and he doesn't cry, but he knows this has to get done. He doesn't fully understand everything, but he knows that this has to be done. And watching people with their mouths agape because, oh my gosh, there's blood. Voodoo and all sorts of things go through their mind. This child is cursed, you know, all those things culturally played into that. And I thank God for my mother-in-law who brought me a nanny who we didn't know at the time, but was smart and picked things up. And so here I am with my books on diabetes management. I mean, books on how to, you know, take care of him. And I go and I'm trying to find a doctor and I'm trying to talk to people. And I ended up literally having to teach my nanny how to help him. And she was smart and she understood and she could do the math, because it came down to being able to do math. Because we were using a counting carbs mechanism. Everything. He didn't put a thing in his mouth unless we counted the carb on it. But the trauma of all that, and I think getting back to what you're saying, the stress of dealing with him affected me.
Yeah.
No sleep. I think it wasn't until we moved back here. So he moved back here at, you know, what, age 11 or 12 from, you know, we spent 10 years there. And he moved back here. And I literally had to say, God, I need sleep. I cannot keep getting up at 2 a.m. checking him to make sure he hasn't tanked. And right. I'm going to trust you that my son is going to be alive when I go in there in the morning. And we all know what lack of sleep, proper sleep does to our bodies, our hearts, everything is affected. And I think that was part of the stuff that I had to deal with, because although my husband was there initially, because I had a nanny, he stepped out. And when I moved here, there was no nanny. And I got back to the, it's all on me, and the no sleep.
Right.
And to me, that was traumatic. His whole life was a trauma for me. I'm sorry, that may not be nice to say, but it was a trauma for
me. But it's true.
You know, it changed any dreams that I had, any desires that I had. My whole life, I had to have him to the hip. I couldn't let him just go to school and be a normal kid. He literally had to have somebody there, because those teachers and the administrators didn't really understand what it was what you had to key into. Was he, you know, and it seemed like his symptoms of a low were the opposite for what someone might be if they were high. You know, he wasn't lethargic. He got keyed up, you know. And so I had to have my nanny there. Thank God, you know, I'm paying her to do this, mind you. But she was there from the time of drop off in the morning, the whole school day. She sat outside the classroom. She, when there was snack time, she came in, she tested his blood sugar. We already had his lunches pre-made, so we didn't have to worry about that. She knew how much insulin. I showed her how to do that. We did all that ahead of time. But somebody had to be there because I could not trust the teachers to understand, like a parent understands, how you have to keep an eye on a child who cannot necessarily communicate to you, Mom, I'm low. I need a snack. You know?
Yeah.
So I thank God for that. But and he is at this point in his life, he's over it. He is over it. And I said, you cannot be over it. You've had this too long.
Right.
You're at the stage where if you don't get yourself together, and that's my trauma now. How do I let go when I don't feel that he is truly, I mean, he's at work now. And I have to say, when I drop him off at work, I'm sorry. My son does not have a license. No license. And because I don't know if you're going to do what you need to do to check yourself before you get behind the wheel.
Right.
My mother.
Because we've heard those stories. Yeah.
Oh,
people
yes.
going low while they're driving, they pass out. It's a whole thing. And it's terrible.
Exactly.
It's horrifying.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. But if I tell him that, that's going to be more trauma on him. You know,
yeah.
So it's just, I'm in this cycle, you know. He wanted to go a couple of years ago. He wanted to go for spring break. He wanted to go to Boston to see a friend. Absolutely not. You're not taking care of yourself the way you need to. You're not going to go and become a burden on somebody else. I'm not going to be sitting up here waiting for a phone call that my son is in an emergency room. And I'm sorry, I'm not going to feel sorry, you know, for being helicopter because you're not doing it yourself. So that's the battle that I'm in right now. And he has just told me that he wants to live, you know, move into a house with some other friends. Huh? You want to do what? So I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. At some point I'm going to have to let him go. And like I did before, trust God that, you know, you're going to be all right, or you're going to wake up and realize how important it is for you to take care of yourself. But, you know, for my own, this has been a whole 19 years of trauma that I know has affected, you know, my hypertension, which we have now discovered is not based on diet because I've lost the weight. I do exercise. So now the doctor's like, no, this is something that's hereditary and it's elevated and we just have to keep you at a good level, you know.
Yeah.
The diet and exercise for my own pre-diabetes, I'm not even taking that pre-diabetes stuff, you know. I don't check myself regularly. I know that because of my diet, because of my exercise, and intermittent fasting, you and I've discussed that, is a godsend for people who have type 2 diabetes. Intermittent fasting is a godsend. You will lose the weight. You give your body a chance to not be on that constant grind of sugar highs, lows, highs, lows. And that's the real problem with type 2 diabetes. What you eat is a constant release of insulin. And your body gets to the point where they resist the release of insulin. And that's why it's called insulin resistance. And you're just and your body just finally just says, I can't do this anymore. I can't do it anymore.
I'm out.
Yeah. And yeah. and that's when you have to take insulin. I don't take metformin. That's what was prescribed to me. I have the pill sitting there, but my doctor's like, yeah, your A1C is okay, you know, and keep doing what you're doing.
Yeah,
but it's trauma.
I was lucky that I was diagnosed like young and early in the process of the disease, like progression. And I was on metformin for like, I think 8 months. And I was, my goal was just like, I do not want to be tied to a medication for the rest of my life. Like I just do not. And if I ever come across a condition where that is 100% my only option, then sure. But like, as much as I can prevent that, that's my goal. Like, that's why I started hiking. That's why I eat the way I do. That's why I have built a life around spending time outside as much as humanly possible. And that's why I also don't allow my feelings to fester. Like, that's a huge part of diabetes management that I don't think gets enough airtime, is like the stress and the trauma, whether that's ancestral, generational, yours, only yours, whatever. Like, we can't keep going around in circles and not talking about the things that are hard and not talking about the things that make us anxious or depressed, because like all of that compounds itself. And diabetes in and of itself can give you anxiety. Like if you are already have a proclivity to be an anxious person, now you're like, here's what you can and can't eat. Here's what the rest of your life looks like if you don't do this right. That is anxiety inducing like a mofo. Like that is crazy. The stuff that we tell folks. And it's like, I wish that more people would get diagnosed early. I wish more people would get A1C tests like on the regular. Like, I don't know why that's not just part of everybody's standard physical. Like I had to go and get that.
It is. I wasn't, but that's the thing.
Wasn't getting that.
It's more so now.
Yeah.
Which is how they found it for me. When I came in and I said, I just want a total thing. Because like you said, the only time they gave me an A1C test was when I was pregnant. That was it. Well, that was, you know, God knows how many years ago, you know, three kids, four kids ago. But then when I came in and I said I wanted a full physical, that's when they did the A1C. They just said, they just tell you, oh, don't eat. When they tell you don't eat, part of that should be, okay, it's an A1C and it's the other, you know, normal tests that they do. But yeah, it's, I think for Black people, it's a lot of stress. It's a lot of cultural stress that happens to us. And it's where we live. It's the environment that we live in. Is there abuse in the home, either child abuse or domestic abuse? Is it stress because of our environment in terms of where we live? Is the urban setting, there aren't areas to get away and get out. And when you do get out and get away, someone's calling the police on you saying you don't belong here.
Right.
Ooh, and that was gonna be my next question.
It's like, so have you experienced, because I know that there's a ton, it's like rampant in the medical world that Black folks aren't believed or they aren't taken seriously by medical professionals. Since your son was diagnosed so early, I would think that that might not have been an issue, but have you guys faced any of that in your journey through caring for your son and this diagnosis?
Thankfully not. I have not. In fact, I'm thankful that I've had nothing but over the top help, because initially, there was a period in there in the mid 2000s where we lost, in the latter part of the mid 2000s, where we lost health insurance. Okay. We all know how much insulin is. Now, it wasn't as
expensive. Let's talk about that, because I don't know that everybody knows that. Insulin's expensive. And if you don't have insurance, good luck. Yeah.
I have been blessed. Now, we our family twice has faced financial hardship. I personally have gone without preventative care, mammograms, pap smears, dental, because I had to make sure that there was money there so that my son could get his insulin and all the supplies that he needed. That, you want to talk about stress. That was stress. And initially, a bottle of insulin was $240 or less. Then I just started seeing things creep up as it seemed like they came out with insulin pens, because when he was first diagnosed, what was an insulin pen? You know, you were doing a vial. There was no such thing as a pump. You had to get a certain age. And then a pump, which is what he should have been on that young, was a barrier because, he's not. So I don't know if now they put children his age on pumps. Right. You know, that young age, they will put them on a pump now. So I don't know. Maybe I don't know if that was a barrier right there. But now, I mean, I go to, and I have insurance now, and I go to the pharmacy to pick up stuff, and my insurance company just decides, well, we're not going to, you know, pay whatever it is, and you owe us, you know, $600 and some odd. And I'm like, huh? Okay, you need to put that back, put it back on the shelf. And I need to go home and I need to start making some arrangements and calling the insurance company, because he takes two insulins. He takes and that's the thing, type one diabetes is not just one insulin, it's two. You got one that you take for the food that you eat, because it takes 2 to 4 hours for food to, you know, digest and go through your system. So you need to, you know, have an insulin that covers that. Then you need the one that is long acting that will cover you for almost 18 to 24 hours so that your blood sugars don't go up during the day when you're not eating.
Right.
You know, and I'm telling you, I used to be able to go back to where we lived in Nigeria, $2,000 worth of supplies and insulin to last me six months or so. $2,000 isn't enough to last someone that doesn't have insurance 1 month. Now, not enough.
Oh my goodness.
Not enough. It's not enough, including the test strips, including, you know, the needles that you have to get, the pin needles that you have to get, or, you know, a glucagon, for goodness sake, you know, is $250. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know what I'm going to face when I go to the pharmacy to pick up insulin. I literally I have to prepare myself, you know, so, and there are so many organizations out there. I mean, the stress of knowing that an endocrinology, you know, a department or a business, you know, a practice would not even treat my son if he didn't have insurance, because they said I needed a referral. Excuse me? What?
So how many people are undiagnosed and just like suffering? Like, because exactly. If that's the case, because like, and especially when it comes to type one, it's like, yeah, you check your A1C, but then you also have to test for antibodies. You have to go see an endocrinologist. Like, and if you need a referral for that, first of all, like, if you don't have insurance, you're not getting an A1C test. Let's be real. Like, you can go to a lab and pay cash, but like, who knows how to do that? People with insurance probably don't know that you can do that. I only know that because somebody told me. Like, that's not.
Yeah.
Like, and I currently don't have insurance either. I am like rationing test strips, and I check like before I go out on a big adventure to make sure that it's not too high. But otherwise, like, I don't know what my blood sugar is. They told me 2 years ago that I reversed it, but like, I don't know if my living situation now has helped that or hurt that. I haven't had an A1C test in 2 years. So like, I don't know. For all intents and purposes, the last time they told me, I went to the doctor, they're like, yeah, you reversed it. And I was like, cool, I'll believe that, and I'll keep doing what I'm doing.
Right.
And I'm guessing, because I'm not experiencing any symptoms, that that's still the case. But the fact of the matter is, I don't know. And that's underlying anxiety as well.
Exactly.
And knowing that I, like, knowing that I have to pay attention to what I eat, and knowing that right now is a time of financial hardship for us because we're doing everything we can to build this organization, right, which requires us to work on it full time and not part time. So it's like, I'm not going to go get another job because this is my life now. It's just, it's one of those things where it's like, it is such a barrier to living the life you want to live, right, to have any version of this disease. Like, right, and the barriers, right, are different, and they increase depending on what kind you have. But it's like, this is one of the most political diseases because of all the things that impact it: health insurance, right, price of insulin, access to healthcare, access, right, to food, stress reduction, how much, right, money you make, like the pay gap that affects,
right,
this,
right,
because if,
right,
I, if
exactly,
I'm like, I'm a white woman, I have to work however much more to make the same that a white man does, and that gets, and that goes down the scale, Hispanics, Blacks, like it gets worse and worse and worse,
exactly,
as you go down the list of racial groups. And it's like, it's criminal, honestly, that this
is
the way that people are experiencing life here. And also, because type 2 is so is preventable and is so impacted by diet, why are these companies that sell absolute garbage food not responsible for this? Why are Doritos still allowed? Why is soda still allowed? Like, why are they not paying for insulin access?
Why are we serving garbage to our kids for a lunch program in schools?
Right.
Why are we serving,
right,
pizza? Why are we serving mashed potatoes? You know, why are there soda and chips in a vending machine? We are not doing,
right,
the vicious cycle. Every time I look at a commercial on TV and I see, you know, the Frosted Flakes and for goodness sakes, yogurt is one of the worst.
Yo, no
yogurt,
kidding. Yogurt's
yogurt is one of the
sugar.
Worst. Yes. Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me?
And you're positioning it as healthy? It's like unfrozen ice cream.
Exactly. Exactly. And the snacks. When I go, okay, so I am like, I watch all the home shows, you know, not because I don't have cable, but I mean, you know, on YouTube mainly. And I see all these people doing their and great, you're doing a great job organizing your pantry and organizing your refrigerator in all these nice plastic bins. And then I see bins with chips and M&Ms and Pop-Tarts and breakfast bars, you know, and Goldfish. Right. And they're like, oh, and we're going to grab these things when we go out the door. And so the kids can grab and they don't have to ask me, excuse me, the way your child is eating today is going to affect them within the next, because childhood obesity is on the rise. And
yes,
and the prevalence of children with type 2, teens with type 2 diabetes, it is a problem.
Yeah.
And the all that you're eating now is setting them up for failure when they hit their 40s. When they hit their 40s, that's when stuff is going to start kicking in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and trying
to get, and that's assuming that they have a beautiful life between everything else. Like, that's assuming that only thing that sucks is that they're eating poorly.
If right.
they have any kind of trauma, if they start drinking anything, if they start
right.
doing drugs and doing like anything
right.
else, it's going to be even worse.
Right, right. If you live and the closest food store to you is Dollar General.
Right.
Or Dollar Tree. You know, and I've seen those videos of people who go in and say how to eat, you know, a healthy diet at these places. But people who are living that lifestyle, it's cheaper for you to feed your family on McDonald's than it is for you
yep.
to go and get, you know, a bag of frozen vegetables. Do you know how much frozen cauliflower is? Because that's what you need.
More
because,
than a Big Mac.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, the frozen, I mean, the whole thing about education is a big thing too. The whole thing of food education, and the food industry has done a number on this country.
And that pyramid is the biggest load of crap I've ever seen in my life.
The biggest load of crap. And if we if we were able to get a hold of that, you know, I'm not mad when New York decides they want to put a tax on soda. You're daggone right. You're daggone right. They put a tax on cigarettes. They put a tax on alcohol. Put a tax on the soda. Because that you have to hit people in the pocket before they understand. But that doesn't help the people who live in a food desert that don't have farmers markets, that where Whole Foods won't even consider coming to that area. Won't even consider.
And that's the best other thing.
The food services and the food stores and restaurants that sell the healthiest foods are not coming to Black and brown communities. Let's be honest. They're not. Because they know the money
is not
there.
And they're
not
coming to rural communities either.
No, they're not. So
they're in big cities and affluent neighborhoods, which are usually white and gentrified to shit. So the thing that's interesting to me there, well, there's a lot of things that are interesting to me. I get fired up when I talk about this, and I'm glad you're here because this has been fun. the thing that blows my mind is so I grew up in Kansas and then I lived in Tampa and I lived in Chicago and I lived in Austin. And like, I was an athlete. I knew how to eat right, but it really wasn't until I moved to California where it's just like a completely different world out here nutritionally, and all the things that are available and the food trends out here, and everything's happy and healthy and vegan or vegetarian and all this stuff. Like, it wasn't until I moved to Southern California until I learned like how to read a nutrition label and all the things that are messed up in the food system and the food supply chain, and like why we should grow our own food, because like, God forbid anything happens on a global scale, or even just in California. Like, if California, we're going to run out of water in California within like the next 50 to 75 years in SoCal. Right. Like, the water table is gone. And so when we can't grow food, because that's the other thing. Like, and my dad and I actually got into an argument about this because he thought I was lying because it sounds so ridiculous. But California provides food for like most of the world. And he was like, that's not true. I was like, okay, I live here. Yes, it is. And also, like, when we run out of water and we can't provide food for the rest of the world, we're not gonna have food to eat, like, because we provide food for the US and a lot of other folks. Then we're talking like food wars, literally. Like, where do you go to get food when the food supply chain is interrupted? Like, COVID, that was kind of one of those things where I was like, this could be a huge problem. Like, if we are going to not import stuff, and if we're not going to take care of the people that work here, that pick the food, that grow the food, that sell the food, like, we're going to have a huge, huge civil problem here. And that's for everybody. That's not just for folks with diabetes, but especially for folks with diabetes, especially for folks that are trying to control it through diet and exercise. Because if you don't have access, and that's one of my biggest underlying fears at all times right now, is like, if I can't afford healthy food, we're screwed. Like, earlier this year, we were eating it. We were going to the food bank. We were Feeding America customers. And that was like we'd get the stuff that we could afford to get at Trader Joe's. And then everything else was supplemented by food banks. And I tell you what, they don't give you a lot of healthy stuff, or they give you tons of stuff that you could never consume as a family of two. Like, they'll give you 18 pounds of apples. Like, I can't eat 18 pounds of apples. There's only so much stuff I can do with an apple. I need to have diversity in my diet. Like, it's insane. Like, it's absolutely crazy. And like, there are so many gaps that need to be bridged when it comes to access to food, especially in Black and brown communities. Like, that's one of the things that we're doing next year, is we're going around and we're hiking in these different, doing these different urban adventures. One, to show that you don't have to go across state lines or to a national park to have an outdoor experience. You can have them in your own backyard. Chicago, they have a trail that goes all the way around the city. All of it is accessible by public transportation. That opens up so many recreation opportunities to people that otherwise wouldn't be able to experience the outdoors because they don't have access to it. If you don't have reliable transportation, good luck getting to a mountain to hike it. good luck getting to a mountain to hike it if you don't even have mountains. Like most of the country
right.
is not mountainous.
Right.
Like
it's not.
There's so
yeah.
like, it's just, it's wild. So like, we're trying to showcase the accessibility of outdoors, making it more inclusive, because to your point, like if you don't feel safe going outside, you're not gonna.
Right.
So like
right.
we need, there's a lot of things that need to happen to make sure that people feel safe and welcome and included in the outdoors, and access to food for people with diabetes, and all of these other symptoms, all these other things that like impact the way that we live our life. Like 40. So the American Diabetes Association, the latest statistic that I saw says that 49% of US adults are pre-diabetic or living with diabetes. 49%, Marionette. How? Why?
And
why
you can lay
well,
that
we know
squarely.
Why it's a thing. We all just discussed all the
you
things.
Can squarely lay that on the majority of that, probably 95% of that, on the food industry, because all yep. they're trying to do is make a buck, and they come out with these big
yep.
products every year that are don't help you health wise. It's like big
right.
pharma, food industry. You know, nothing is, none of that
it's
stuff
bad.
Is really helping. It doesn't treat anything underlying.
No, and that's the thing is like it looks at the body as like a problem that needs to be fixed and doesn't address the root of the symptoms that we experience. Because
right.
when I went to the doctor, like so I when I got diagnosed, I had been paddleboarding like 2 weeks prior. It was really hot outside. I was out there for too long. I didn't bring enough water. I thought maybe I was dehydrated or maybe I got a heat stroke or something, but I had like serious like gastrointestinal problems for like 2 weeks following that paddleboarding session. I went in there and I told them that, and they were like, cool, sounds like you got Crohn's disease. And I was like, could we maybe
we could talk about
to,
that
like,
too.
Yeah,
crazy.
I was like, I like my best friend Adam who died in 2014, like he had Crohn's disease, and I knew that what I was experiencing was not what he was experiencing, but like even the medical professionals in general, like we have some of the best diagnostic care in the world. I believe that, like I believe that I have type 2 diabetes, true, and also we've got a long way to go when it comes to treating humans as whole organic living breathing
right.
things, because we look
right.
at them like machines or computers, as if every like all of our bodies contain the same parts, but they don't all operate in the same way. And when we
right.
start looking at trauma and access to healthy foods and access to the ability to recreate and move your body based on how much time you have or don't have, and all of these underlying lifestyle factors, then we can make a huge stride and how we treat these folks. But like,
right.
we don't care about that. Doctors get 15
no.
minutes. They barely look at your chart. They kind of like look at you up and down. They're like, you're fat. You're fucked. Right. Like the fat
right.
phobia in
right.
the medical industry
right.
is like, it's so bad. Like, and
right.
that, and that is not doing anybody a service at all. So it's like, it starts with food, I think, first and foremost,
yeah.
and access
oh, yeah.
to it. And then your ability to provide for yourself and for your family. And in a low stress kind of way. Like the reality is this country is so ass backwards with how we live life. Like I look at third world countries that don't have the health problems we have, and I'm like, maybe our industrialized nation is not the way to go.
It is
in the
not.
Philippines, they might be living in a shanty, but they aren't sick. They're some of the happiest people I've met. Like
all over the world,
all these communities where people are like, where Americans are like, oh, they've got it bad. It's like, I don't think they do. Like, just because they don't have a McMansion doesn't mean that they're bad. Like, they're eating foods that grow locally, they're growing them themselves, and they don't have the chronic illnesses that we do.
Certainly not
I'd
to this degree.
I'd rather have my health than a big ass house. Like, I don't know.
you're right. We are living a life, Americans in general want to live a life of convenience. And from living abroad to living here, I feel like I can make that statement. Because
yeah.
I've seen how people now, when I lived over there, I lived very comfortably. I mean, heck, I had a nanny, I had a driver, I had a cook. And I saw how they lived. they weren't going to the doctor, you know, as much. Like you said, they were going to the local markets, what we would call farmers markets, you know, yeah, was
there
steady. That's just
what it is there.
Exactly. That's just what it is there.
That's just how they shop and how they eat.
Exactly. Like, and we're not talking about foods that had a whole lot of pesticides and, right, and
oh,
all
yeah,
that kind of
stuff.
Don't even
get me started on the environmental stuff. Oh my Lord.
Exactly. And so we're here. We want everything like this. We don't want to wait. We don't want to wait for things to grow to maturity. We want the yield to be, you know, to quicken so they can get it to market and hurry up and make their money. And I saw how people lived in African countries. And I'm thinking, now I'm at the stage now, well, shoot, my kids are at the age and stage where they're about to get out on their own. And I'm considering van life.
Go for it, my, girl. Oh, tell you what, it's the best decision I've ever made for myself.
I am dead serious about this. I was watching a van life video today and my husband overheard and he's like, oh, whoa, what are they talking about there? You know, vans, yeah, that'd be nice. I said, hon, I am dead serious.
Real talk,
this.
Let's do it.
Oh no, I'm not even including him. This is just me. This is just me. I told him, I said, I want to downsize so that I can decrease my stress. It's the stuff.
It is. I'll tell you what.
That you have. That trying
it's amazing that
it,
you know that before
get
getting rid of it. Yeah.
You know, yeah. So I told him, I said, this is what I want. The next car you buy me, because you're going to buy me one, I want it to be a van and I want to kit it out. And it doesn't need to be a big deal kit. I said, because I want to travel and I don't want to pay $1,500 to stay in a hotel. I want to pull up in somebody's driveway that I'm visiting. I don't need to come in and use your bathroom. I might use the shower. I might use your washing machine, but that's going to be about it. I'm going to be outside in your driveway, sleeping in my van, having a good old time. And then I'm going to be gone in about 2 days and I'm off to the next spot. And people look at, what? And you, how old? It doesn't matter.
That doesn't matter.
I don't need all this stuff. I don't need it. I want to get rid of it. The next move I make will be severely, severely, like, it's not going to be, this stuff going to be gone. And I'm only keeping it because of my, if I keep any of it, it's going to be because of him and the kids. So they have somewhere to go, but I'm going to be gone. Okay.
Yeah. I'm out.
I'm out.
I've got
because
it.
it's stress trying to keep up with this. And I have no delusions. I've been blessed. I've been a stay-at-home mom, you know, for all these years. I've only worked a few times. You know, we've had some financial things and I've gone back to work, but it certainly has not been where I'm punching anybody's clock. It's been a side hustle here, a side hustle there, you know, whatever I can do. And I'm in one of those side hustle times, but that's about to come to an end. And when it does, I'm coasting because I'm going to be 58 next year. And I've told him, I said, my body's tired. I'm not waiting another minute. I cannot keep doing this. I'm going to go set up the house and then I'm hitting the road. I'll see you in that, because he doesn't even live here. So he gets the luxury of coming back and forth. You know, king of the castle here, king of the castle there, you know, but I've got to reduce the stress. And I also want to show my kids, don't get sucked into the debt trap. If you can't pay it outright, don't get it. The finer things in life, what America says are the final things in life, are what's killing people. It's giving people stress. It's giving people trauma. It's what people are working 3 and 4 jobs to either get or keep. It's for some people. I mean, and I'm going to be honest with you. I live in a predominantly white area. And I know that a lot of these people that have these nice fancy houses around me, their mamas and daddies are putting their kids through private school. They don't have that money.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, but you want to run around here and pretend like right. you have that
and
money.
And for what? Like,
for what? I mean, most of us are living above our means. We're not even living, we're slightly within. And just because you can buy it doesn't mean you should buy it. What are you teaching your kid? And I'm not, you know, don't come for me, people. Don't come for me. I'm going to let you, do not come for me. Talking about, well, Black people, we have a right to, look, if you have money, you have a private jet, you have this, fine. But that's not the average Joe's experience. It is not the average Joe's experience. And we can't look at the 1% and say we've been left behind. We still have to live our lives in such a way that we are not stressing ourselves out trying to live like somebody else.
That's the root of it all.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if we can just like slow down, reevaluate our priorities, live within our means, and then like fix everything that's messed up about the food system and the healthcare system and everything else that's contributing to this disease and all the other diseases that are rampant in this society, we can make some serious changes in this world. Let's slice it up, Marionette.
Exactly. And for me, it's about helping someone besides myself. Helping someone besides myself, because focusing on you is stress too. Mm-hmm. Focusing just on you is a stress. So, you know, we got it backwards. We've got it backwards in this country, and it's and I don't know what we need to do to fix it, but it's looking outward.
Well, I think it's conversations like this. I think it's having conversations like this. It's getting active in our communities and taking care of the people that we care about, because like we're especially just as a country we're so divided, and just as communities we're so divided, like there's not a tribal communal village type vibe anywhere in this country anymore, really. Like we're all individualistic.
And the people that have that did not start out here. They're the immigrants that came in that help each other,
right? Yeah.
You know,
true story.
So yeah, that's just,
Barbara, did you have any questions before we wrap things up here? She's still listening.
No question.
Okay. All right then. Well, Marionette, thank you so much for your time. I love chatting with you. I'm just going to like schedule a monthly call with Marionette for everybody to just come listen to us jam about stuff. Cause it's just nice to chat with somebody who gets it and who also gets fired up the way I do about these things. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having
for anybody that's
Sydney.
Watching, you guys can follow Marionette, on Instagram. She's at Mocha Mama Trex. And if you're interested in joining her team on Kilter for our Diabetes Awareness Month campaign, you can join Mocha's in Motion and track your miles towards our goal. Yeah, track your miles towards our goal of hiking 1,000,000 miles for diabetes awareness. So thank you again for joining us tonight. And I hope you have a wonderful rest of your week, and stay safe, stay healthy, and give that sun a big old hug for us.
I'll do that. You too.
All right. Thank you so much. All right. Okay. We'll chat soon.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye.
Set myself free while I'm hiking my feelings.
Thank you for joining us around the virtual campfire. Sometimes we talk about heavy topics, sometimes we tell poop stories, but regardless of what we've discussed, we always like to end the show on a high note. At the end of our live broadcasts, we invite our community to share what they're grateful for in a segment called the Group Gratitude Circle. Every week, I'm thankful for you. Thank you for taking time out of your busy life to connect with us and witness these stories of hope, healing, and inspiration in the outdoors. If you'd like to gather with us around the campfire live each week, join the Hiking My Feelings virtual campfire VIPs. If this were a legit talk show, you'd be sitting in our studio audience. We haven't been picked up by a major network yet, so for now, we gather on Zoom. Here, you can connect with the community before and after the broadcast, hang out for sound check when we have musical guests, participate in the Q&A, join in on the group gratitude circle, and be eligible to receive prizes and gifts from our sponsors, partners, and guests. Learn more and join us at hikingmyfeelings.org/campfire. Don't forget to leave a review, subscribe, and share this episode with your friends, family, colleagues, and anyone else who could use a dose of community and connection. Follow us on Instagram. We're at Hiking My Feelings, and you can tag your journey with #HikingMyFeelings. And if you're picking up what we're putting down and you want to be part of this movement, join the Hiking My Feelings family at family.hikingmyfeelings.org. In case nobody told you lately, you are a brilliant human who is destined to do epic things in this world. Join us next week for more stories of hope, healing, and inspiration in the outdoors. Until then, happy trails!